Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Hi there, Thrive Deeper listeners. Before we continue our study through Isaiah with Matt, I just want to highlight that we have restarted our Thrive Perspectives podcast series. Over the next 4 to 5 episodes, Matt, myself, and our good friend and critical thinker, Connell, will be exploring our worldview and how this informs every aspect of our lives, how we think, behave, what we see as our priorities and purpose in life. This is such a timely conversation in this day and age, with so many influences and voices shouting at us for our attention. What does a Christian worldview look like, and how do we live out our lives in this context? So join us at Thrive Perspectives as we explore our Christian worldview. You can find the Perspectives podcast at our website, thrivetoday.tv, or at your favorite podcasting platform. Now, back to our study through Isaiah.
Man, yep. I don't know where the years are going. I think it's got something to do with getting older. I've figured out that every year is a smaller percentage of your overall life as you get older.
It's a mathematical explanation.
It's a mathematical explanation. So, therefore, every year seems like it's going faster because it is actually less of your entire life. So,
speaking of mathematics, what are we up to, Stu?
Yeah, right. Well, Thrive Deeper, episode 161, and we are going to be continuing on in the book of Isaiah. And we're going to be picking up from chapter 13, and we'll probably aim to get somewhere near chapter 30. We'll just see how we go. But just a bit of background, Matt, before we kick in. For listeners who were listening to the previous episode, you will remember that Isaiah was a prophet who lived in Jerusalem in the last part of the two kingdom period, where we had Israel in the north and Judah in the south. And his prophetic word was directed to the leaders of Jerusalem and Judah primarily. He preached God's judgment was going to come to Israel and Judah through the nations of Assyria and, of course, later on Babylon, and we'll hear a bit more about that soon, because they basically refused to turn from their idolatry and oppression of the poor. But as we've already seen in Isaiah and in the other minor prophets that we've looked at, this message of judgment is delivered with a message of hope as well, that in spite of this judgment and the nation's continued disobedience, God one day will fulfill his covenant promises, all of them, through an everlasting king of David's line. And so we sort of pick up at, you know, we ended at chapter 12 with a song of praise after, you know, again, that sort of offer of hope. And then we start on these series of oracles of judgment.
It's interesting, the consistent thing in the prophets is certainly God's commitment to his covenant. That is a massive theme that runs right through the prophets. In the midst, I may say, of these oracles of doom upon those people for not trusting actually in God's faithfulness.
Yeah.
So the message is always God is faithful, but are you going to be faithful? Mm. And your faithfulness depends on whether you actually get to be a beneficiary of God's faithfulness.
Yeah.
So you get this sense that he's saying God is willing to be faithful to you, but whether you're and God is going to bring about his plan, but whether you're going to be part of it depends on your faithfulness and your decision.
Yeah,
that seems to be quite a ever-present message through the prophets, certainly in Isaiah, as I've noticed that. There's a lot of history going in the background. This is one of the things that's complicated about reading the prophets. And I think a little key, and I may have said this before, Stu, for me, reading through these oracles, the primary thing that I get out of this is a sense of God's heart, ultimately. It's not like God is delighting in these oracles of doom. There's a real sense of grief here. Mm. And that grief is actually often expressed in Isaiah the prophet himself. I don't know if you notice that, but at regular intervals, you know, Isaiah just breaks down and is just mourning and weeping. And this isn't the prophet saying, "Oh God, you're so mean and I'm the sensitive one." No, this is a prophetic lamenting that he's doing here. And so this is God lamenting over the plight of his people, and particularly their spiritual state, that such a thing is necessary, because he's going to have to prune the diseased branches, as it were, in order to save the tree. And that's kind of what's happening here. So I think, you know, in reading these, just a tip for readers, just try to get the sense of God's heart in all of this. And there are just some beautiful things that are said. There are some very, very convicting things often through this, and let that be sobering for you. Mm. Try to pick up the main theme. What is God? Ask the question, what is God really wanting of his people? Mm. And what you'll notice through here, and it's expressed in so many ways, very moving ways, God is saying, I just want you to trust me.
Yeah.
I just want you to trust me. Keep running off to everyone else. That's what, you know, against the historical backdrop of turbulent shifting of nations and political machinations.
Yep.
And, you know, who are we going to back? You know, we're going to back them, or are we going to back them?
And God's kind of going, pick me.
But, well, you know, a little bit more.
Of course, of course.
But majesty than that. But certainly.
The point is.
You sense the heart of God, exactly, don't you? Right. Saying,
I'm right here.
You know. I am faithful. Yeah. You know, And
particularly when it comes to, and we'll get to this, the judgment of Jerusalem, you know, and here they are doing everything that they can. And yet the whole founder of the city of David, the one who founded it, is there waiting to come to rescue, you know, yet they won't go to him, you know, and it's like.
And in fact, the climax of this whole first half of the book of Isaiah that we'll look at in the next episode is that amazing story of Hezekiah when the Syrians came to the walls and Hezekiah cried out to God and, you know, and this amazing salvation, which sits there. You know, why is that story repeated wholesale? Because it's retold in Kings and Chronicles. Mm. Why does it appear there in Isaiah? And that's because it is God showing. He's showing, I am, if you trust me, if you cry, this is what is actually possible. Yeah. You don't need to go to Egypt or go to these other nations to protect yourselves, because I'm able to do that. And so.
But remember, Isaiah wrote this before it had happened.
Yeah.
Whereas Kings and Chronicles were historical records. Yeah. So, you know, it's like, here's the foretelling, then the actual event recorded. And I guess one of the things for me reading through this is our Western culture tends to want us to try to read everything chronologically. It's like, this and then that and then this and then that. But this isn't, it kind of goes a bit over the place. And I think you got to let go of that sense of, oh, so now the next scene is this. Well, no, actually now we're referring back to something back here. Yeah, I think you can get comfortable with that. I think that helps with it as well.
So there's a lot of, there is editorial work here because that story was included pretty much wholesale. But the point is that it's part of the overall prophetic message that the book of Isaiah as a whole conveys. Mm. And that is this idea that God is able to do this.
I think just before we jump in, just to keep us humble, because I found myself reading this and kind of going, what's wrong with these people, you know, kind of thing. And yet every day in our lives, we're probably guilty of similar things where we, instead of going to God first, it's kind of the last resort. Well, we've tried everything else. Maybe now we'll pray. You know, it's like,
and these people are facing threats the like of which we could not imagine. I mean, you know, the Assyrians are coming. The Assyrians are well known for being, I mean, they used fear as a
tactic.
They would line the roads of conquered cities with people impaled on poles and you know, unleash just horrible tortures upon people purely to just send horror out before them. We just can't even imagine this. So this is, you know, no wonder they're looking for, you know, foreign alliances and how are we going to stand against this Assyrian onslaught. You know, it's you kind of try to imagine just the level of threat that you're facing at this time. So speaking of the political backdrop, as we come into chapter 13, Stu, we have this prophecy against Babylon. You think, well, hang on, why are we getting a prophecy against Babylon? Because isn't this about Assyria? Mm. Well, this is where some of these background events. There'd been a change of rulers in the Assyrian Empire. Babylon is a city-state that is part of the bigger Assyrian empire at this stage.
Yep.
And that's a very powerful city-state. And there's this you know, the beginnings of rebellion now.
Power struggle going on.
Already earlier, and now this actually comes to a head because there's a rebellion. Mm. And everyone's looking on, in a way. There's no TVs to watch the news, but everyone's kind of looking on. And certainly, there are frequent,
emissaries,
travel, the travel routes are all, open and lots of emissaries going back and forth. And, so everyone's waiting to see, okay, what they've heard about this rebellion. Is this going to succeed? Maybe this will be the thing that stops the Assyrians. You can imagine.
Yeah.
Oh, great! Babylon's rebelled, and they're going to destroy us. We'll be okay.
Yep.
And you're kind of looking for a bit of light at the end of the tunnel. Isaiah, his message is no. That's not the end. The end of the tunnel. God is the light at the end of the tunnel. And so,
doesn't matter who wins this. Really?
At the end of the day. And he actually foretells here the failure of that rebellion. Now, as we know, Babylon ultimately destroys Assyria at the famous Battle of Carchemish in 605 BC. But here, we're around 722 BC still. Okay, so that's...
And the Babylonians, if we recall listeners, they also came to Judah looking for an alliance to help them against the Assyrians, which of course the Judeans
that was the issue in chapter 7.
Exactly right.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's already happened.
That's right. So the question is, will the revolt of Babylon be successful? Mm. And a lot of people are thinking it would be. Now, as we know, ultimately it is, but Isaiah says, no, it won't be. And this is the amazing thing about these oracles. One after another in his prophecies is
spot on.
Hits the nail on the head, So he says, no. And so there's this this prophecy against Babylon. Mm. Part of this is because Assyria is his chosen instrument.
Yes.
This is – and part of what's going on here is that we have this picture of God as Lord over all of the nations. Now, remember, this is in a time where people believed in territorial gods.
Yes.
And battles were between one god and another god. Mm. This completely flies. This is the theology that comes out of Isaiah. Completely flies in the face of that, because this is not one God fighting against another God. No, this is a sovereign God who is sovereign over all of the machinations of the nations, and is going to, like Assyria, which is the most powerful, formidably powerful empire in that day. The Lord says, "Oh yeah, they're just an instrument of discipline in my hand." That's all that they are. And so this uprising of Babylon, oh, maybe this is going to thwart the onslaught. No, God's, no, it's not. Because they're an instrument in my hand. And
I'll decide.
And I'll decide this, thank you very much. So you get this amazing message of sovereignty over the nations.
Which then is reinforced as we go through, and we'll move through these together, obviously, but he then goes through all the nations that are really surrounding Israel and Judah at the time and, puts the judgment on them, all who have their own deities in a sense, are trying to, so, and interestingly enough, in this case, with the Babylonians in the first instance, when they came to Judah for support, it was the Medes that God used to actually destroy the Babylonians. Yeah. The Medes are probably the current day Iranians.
Yeah.
And so just interesting how God's just going to use whatever instrument he needs to bring about his purpose.
That's right. So, one other thing about Babylon, too, is that you get this sense that with Babylon, particularly because of the city and the presence of the Tower of Babel earlier, which is probably a ziggurat. There's something about Babylon, that God has His eye on, a particular eye on Babylon as a symbol of something bigger. There's something about Babylon here. And this is always made evident when Babylon gets brought up. And we know from, of course, the book of Revelation that the world system is referred to as Babylon. So in fact, both at the beginning and the end of the Bible, we have Babylon as a symbol for humanity and rebellion against God. Mm. So the Tower of Babel is Tower of Babylon.
Yep.
In Genesis chapter 11, and then in the book of Revelation, of course, as well. And so I think it's important to keep that in mind whenever there are these prophecies against Babylon. And so you do get this apocalyptic language that seems to cast broader, So verse 9 of chapter 13, see the day of the Lord is coming.
Yeah.
Now, when it talks about the day of the Lord, that the scope always widens. It's the great day of judgment, yep, in a sense. But of course, the judgments that are going to be faced by the people immediately are a kind of foretaste, in a way, of that judgment. But, you know, it talks about the day of the Lord is coming, a cruel day with fierce wrath and anger to make the land desolate, destroy the sinners within it. Mm. The stars of heaven and their constellations will not show their light. The rising sun will be dark and the moon will not give its light. This is the same language that Jesus uses in Matthew chapter 24,
yeah,
to describe the tumult of the nations.
Yeah.
It's not describing the end of the space-time universe.
No, no.
It's described. This is a standard way of describing the tumult and the complete upset of the world system.
And similar language to what we see in Revelation 17 and 18 when we're talking about, you know, that kind of that similar sort of apocalyptic language there as well. So, you know, it's definitely foreshadowing something greater than just judgment on the city of or the nation of Babylon at that time, for sure.
Yeah. So, because he says that in verse 11, I will punish the world for its evil. I mean, you know, he's throwing the scope wide. And then, and of course, at the beginning of chapter 14, you have, because this is how you know he's sort of projecting beyond this. This is the thing with these prophecies. It's the foreshortening thing. He's looking at immediate events are prefigurative of ultimate events. Yeah. You've got this often this double thing happening. And so he speaks of the ultimate compassion he's going to have on Jacob. Of course, Jacob being, you know, the father of the 12 sons, you know, his 12 sons, 12 tribes of Israel. Once again, he will choose Israel and settle them in their own land and so forth. You get this this promise.
And it's odd that it's right there. I mean, when I came to him, I'm going, so it's all done now. But then you're back into the judgment again. It's like,
you're back into judgment.
Is that just to keep us listening? You know, you know, but it's again, these things where he's pointing forward to say, but God is still going to be faithful, ultimately faithful to his covenant and promises.
And know? in that context, because he's saying that ultimately, in an these things are going to, God's promises about the land and his people and everything are going to be full. And it says, on that day, the Lord gives you relief from your suffering and turmoil. You will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon. Mm. And then it goes, you know, it continues. So you, this is where you get this sense. Oh, no, hang on. The occasion is Babylon going to succeed? Is this revolt of Babylon going to succeed? But this is used prefiguratively as a picture of something bigger. And so, because it's interesting that this taunt that's taken up against the king of Babylon is reflected in the book of Revelation.
Yes.
In I think it's Revelation 18, where it says, you know, fallen is Babylon, you know, and again, similar sort of taunt. Mm. Now, the interesting thing in chapter 14 is that it says this, let me read this to you, Stu. This is interesting. From verse 12, chapter 14, how you have fallen from heaven, morning star, son of the dawn, you have been cast down to earth. You who once laid low the nations, you said in your heart, I will ascend to the heavens. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit enthroned on the Mount of Assembly, on the utmost heights of Mount Zaphon. I will ascend to the tops of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High.
Yeah.
But you are brought down to the realm of the dead, to the depths of the pit. Mm. Well, okay, that's, again, talk about casting a wider vision here. You know, Babylon is, he takes actually what is a not unfamiliar mythology from the context, Canaanite mythology, about sort of battles between the gods and one god trying to usurp the place of another. But of course, Jesus alludes to this sort of idea when he says in Luke chapter 10, his disciples come back and say, hey, even the demons submit to us.
Yeah.
And he says, I saw Satan falling like lightning from heaven.
Yeah.
And it's kind of an allusion to this, you know, to this sort of idea here. And so there's this sense, and with the way that Babylon is depicted in the Bible broadly, there's this sense in which Babylon is characterized almost as Satan himself. Because this is the kind of thing that, you know, of course, that Satan does and you know, he tempts Adam and Eve to rebel, saying, Yep. Because then you will be like God, yep. right? Yep. So it's like, come and join me. We can be like God.
Build this tower. We can get up to the gods.
Beyond, let's build this tower yep. and we'll get up to the gods. Mm. And it's, you know, the Tower of Babel reaching heaven is actually about them rivaling the gods in a sense, you know. So you get this consistent God complex of humanity coming through, and that is Babylon becomes the ultimate expression. Throughout the Bible, you know, Babylon really becomes the ultimate.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, the Roman Empire, probably in Revelation, part of that is that the Roman Empire is being characterized as a Babylon. It's just another Babylon. It's a world. Yeah. It's a world system. So very interesting. Wow. Very interesting here. If we
move on to the Philistines,
If we move on to the Philistines. Part of the purpose of these, and there's a few prophecies against some of the nations. Basically, this begins a series of judgments against those neighboring nations.
Yeah.
Because Judah was very tempted to trust them for deliverance.
Yes, that's right.
That's the point. So basically the prophet is declaring, no, those nations are under the same sentence as you are.
Yes.
Right? Because you've worshipped their gods. You've acted just like them, right? So this rod in the hand of God, Assyria, is coming down. And it's judgment against the Moabites, the Philistines, the Ammonites, the upon Egypt even.
Yep.
And you know, and you as well. Yes. Why you as well? Because you've just become just like them. Pretty much. So, so that's and again, you get here, this theme of God's sovereignty over all of the nations.
Mm. And interesting, we'll skip past this, but interesting in each of those. If you look at the core kind of factors, like around the Philistines, for instance, they were. You know, they were hoping that the Assyrian Empire would be defeated. So they were putting their hope in that because that would lift the oppression because they'd been kind of subjected to Assyrian rule. Obviously, that ended up happening anyway. For the Moabites, they were a very proud people, you know. And you know, so in a sense, Isaiah and God are saying all these different traits where you think you're going to take care of things yourselves, I'm going to show you that there is only one God here, and that's me, and I'll decide who comes and who goes. So as we work through all of those, you see that come out again and again. You know,
that's right.
It's
interesting, and going back to your point, Stu, about the arrangement of the material, often it's thematic as well. It's kind of works thematically because some of these oracles may have been in response to particular occasions. So, for example, it seems that Moab, when the Assyrians actually came into the land and they attacked Moab first, because of course they don't want to have a big pincer movement when they go down the main highway. They've got to get rid of all of these surrounding nations so that they're not
ambushed
themselves, surrounded. You know, so Ammon and Moab are going to be the first to go down, and the Moabites. Seem to have sent a delegation, like there are Moabite refugees that come and they send tribute, and so start of chapter 16, send lambs as tribute to the ruler of the land from Selah across the desert. It goes, like fluttering birds push from the nest, so are the women of Moab at the fords of the Arnon. So he's, you know, they're coming. Can you help us?
Refugees, essentially.
Can you help us? And so these are oracles directed into that situation. It's interesting in this context. It says, in love, a throne will be established. In faithfulness, a man will sit on it. One from the house of David, one who in judging seeks justice and speeds the cause of righteousness. Hezekiah. But of course, remember, we're always looking beyond Hezekiah.
Yes, that's right.
Isaiah's always looking beyond. Now, probably, in a way, probably Hezekiah, but there's a very strong messianic theme that runs through Isaiah's prophecies. So he's always pointing his people's hope to the right thing, isn't he?
Yeah.
We've got prophecies against Damascus, chapter 17, prophecy against Cush, which is Arabia, Ethiopia. Yeah, that's right.
Which had sort of taken over Egypt, the rule of Egypt by that stage. The Ethiopians were actually the dominant ruling class in in Egypt. So when you can kind of interchange Ethiopia, Egypt as one, one nation. So
and that's handy to, again, because Kush and Egypt are always spoken of together from here, and you think, why? What's going on there? Of course, there's there are real historical events going. So essentially, an Ethiopian king is the pharaoh of Egypt at this stage. So again, there's this, this theme of who are you going to rely on? Because of course, Egypt is a major force, and they're going to. There's going to be a lot of oracles about Egypt from Isaiah because that's the most the best horse to bet on, so to speak, for Judah. Yep. You know, let's go to the Egyptians.
Actually, the Egyptians came to Judah in the first instance and said, you know, they were looking conspire against the Assyrians, which of course that didn't work.
And the reason for that is because they're on the way, right? Judah can cushion, they're the cannon fodder.
Yeah, exactly.
They really don't care about Judah. Yes. Judah are the cannon fodder.
Yes.
And this is what Isaiah, it's Isaiah sitting in the background saying, guys, you are just their cannon fodder. Okay, don't trust Egypt. Don't enter into an alliance with them. It's not going to work out. But of course, Egypt / Ethiopia are wanting them to, to form this alliance to fight with them, and that'll cushion a lot of the blow because they have to come down.
Yeah.
They have to come because they can't just come across the desert.
No.
So they come from the east, but they go north, right round, down through present day, like near where Turkey is, Syria. That's right. They're going to come all the way down there. That's the only way to get to Egypt. So that's what those are about. So,
interesting at the end of chapter 19, which is continues the oracle against Egypt, obviously, Egypt will know the Lord. Isaiah foresaw a time when Egypt and Assyria would worship the one true God. So,
yeah, that's right.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, this is an interesting one, Stu, because this is one of these instances where Isaiah actually acts out.
Yes.
A prophet acts out a prophecy. Mm. So it says in chapter 20, in the year the supreme commander sent by Sargon, king of Assyria, came to Ashdod and attacked and captured it. At that time, the Lord spoke through son of Amos. He said to him, part of this is that Egypt, there's this rebellion, Ashdod rebels and... trusting in Egypt.
Yes.
That's the gamble here. And so the Lord says to Isaiah, take off the sackcloth from your body. Interesting that he's wearing sackcloth.
Mm.
So up to this point, he has actually been already demonstrating his message. He's in mourning.
Yes, he's in mourning.
Right.
Yeah.
He's not clicking his tongue and just pointing the finger and saying, aha, there you go. And
I told you so.
I told you. No. He's actually in mourning for all of this.
These are his people.
Absolutely. Yeah. And again, remember, in his mourning, he's expressing the heart of God over these people. Mm.
Which is interesting because we'll come to something a little later that we can speak to where there's, we'll come to that later, where again, the sense of us being able to mourn with God what he mourns at.
That's right. So he tells Isaiah that he's got to strip and he's got to go around stripped and barefoot for 3 years.
Yeah. I mean, as if anyone's going to listen to him after that.
Yeah. Like that's because, and the message is because the Egyptians are going to be conquered and they're going to be like, they're going to be naked refugees.
Yeah.
So here's Isaiah. Now, was he completely naked? I mean, you probably sense he had a loincloth or something like that on. But he's getting around.
The point is, yeah.
So it says in verse 3, then the Lord said, just as my servant Isaiah has gone stripped and barefoot for 3 years as a sign and a portent against Egypt and Cush, so the king of Assyria will lead away stripped and barefoot Egyptian captives in Cush. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't want to have been a prophet.
No.
Wow.
That would have been against the odds at that point in time.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
Yeah. I mean, but even to have to go around stripped and barefoot, man, you're really, and what a, because Isaiah already at this stage would have been very much a well-known figure. So for him to be walking around the city stripped and barefoot, why? So the question is again, why is this, like, why all of that? Because that's just about Egypt. Why does anyone, you know, care about Egypt? Well, partly it's because it shows God's sovereignty over the nations, but largely to show Judah that God is sovereign over the nations. Because the whole time, Isaiah is, by acting this out, has been prophesying the doom of Egypt.
Yes.
Egypt's going to fall.
Yeah.
And so when that happens, it's clear.
Judah's also.
God is sovereign.
Yeah.
Well, it's very clear that Isaiah's right in everything that he's saying.
Yeah.
And that God is completely sovereign. Because see, if Isaiah is correct, then
everyone else
it shows that God is sovereign because God has declared this through Isaiah. Come back to a prophecy against Babylon.
Again.
Man, this is real international stuff here. Everything big that's happening in the world, the known world at this time, is being spoken of by Isaiah. He's addressing the whole lot. This is a prophet of the nations, not just a prophet, you know, speaking to some little people group. This has a global scope. And notice he says in verse 3 of chapter 21, Stu, at this my body is racked with pain. Mm. Pangs seize me like those of a woman in labor.
Yep.
I am staggered by what I hear. I am bewildered by what I see. So he receives this word and these visions from God, and he has it physically. He's physically filled with pain. I mean, it's he carries it. It's so real to him that it actually his body actually manifests the pains
of it
of the trauma of the things that are going to happen. You know, this isn't just someone getting a word and nonchalantly passing it on. This is the interesting thing that I find here about this minister, the prophetic ministry, is that he really carried the burden of this message.
Yeah.
And this is important to you. I was reflecting on this because, of course, according to Joel chapter 2, you know, in those days, you know, young men will see vision, old men will dream dreams and so forth.
Yes.
And the point is that in the new covenant time that we're now, we will all be anointed as prophets to the nations, all of us.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, when you read these prophecies of Isaiah, you get a sense of what it actually means to carry this mantle and to be on this kind of mission. It's not just passing on, it's actually you are embodying a message. You embody the burden of this message. Mm. You don't, you know, you're not standing aside from people. You're actually feeling, I mean, and here he's feeling the pain of Babylon, essentially.
Mm.
You know, so it's, yeah, very, very, very interesting stuff.
Yeah,
So,
again, oracles against Duma, which is part of Arabia at the time, then one against the larger state of Arabia. And even some timing on that, he talks about Kedar, which was a big city that would fall within a year. So there's, you know, some very specific timing around,
That's right.
Around that stuff as well. And then we move on to obviously an oracle against Jerusalem.
Yeah. So this, the historical background to this, just let's be reminded of the story here. So we're probably in the time of Hezekiah here now.
Yes.
It looks like we're in the time of Hezekiah. Remember when the Assyrians, they came down as Isaiah predicted. They laid waste to those nations, okay, as he predicted. They lay waste to Samaria as well. And then they're coming Jerusalem's way. Now, at first, Hezekiah pays them off.
Yes.
Massive tribute. However, after that, they do come back, and that's the famous story about them at the walls of Jerusalem and you know, what God does there. But what we don't know is how much time between those two things. Now, Hezekiah paying them off, you know, there was no sense there that, you know, he consulted God like he did the second time. We don't need to see Hezekiah, even though he's the good king, he's very far from flawless. In fact, he does do some wonderful reforms and all of that sort of stuff, and he trusts God, but he's certainly not without his flaws. So he has this moment where he pays off the king of Assyria. Now, this could be where these prophecies now take place, because presumably Isaiah had been preparing them for the next onslaught.
Yes.
And also to the extent that when they do come back, Hezekiah does go before the Lord, right? Yeah. So what's the change? You think, okay, the first time he tried to pay them off, the second time they come back and they're back for more. So why doesn't he just pay them off the second? Because again, they're willing. All they say the second time is, you know, just let us become, you know, a vassal state to Assyria and we'll leave you alone, right? This time, he's not going to do that. Mm. And he goes and he seeks God. So it may well be that the very oracles that were written is in the hearing of Hezekiah actually really stirred his heart and stirred up the faith that we see expressed. Yeah.
And as you say, you know, at that time, they still relied on their own efforts. They went and fortified the city walls. They went and built alternative water supplies. It's like, let's do everything we can. Instead of just straight away going to God, it wasn't until they realized none of that was actually going to make a difference.
And it wasn't that doing those things was wrong necessarily. No. It's just that there was a lot of activity before they even ever got to seeking God.
Yeah.
And I mean a lot of activity. One of those activities, I have to point this out because I've walked through this tunnel, Stu, is the and it's famous because it's an amazing work of engineering. Mm. And I say done in a hurry. So there's a spring that's just outside the walls of Jerusalem, and that could potentially sustain an invading army. Yeah. So what they did is that they closed up that spring and they diverted the water underground for, it's about 700 meters, I think, underground.
That's huge.
This amazing tunnel that you can walk through today, and I have walked through it, and maybe some of those listening have as well, that two different work groups worked from either end and met in the middle. It's just amazing. Yeah. And the whole thing flows in the way that it should flow. It's got the right gradient to it.
Yeah.
Man, amazing piece of engineering here. So you know, three cheers to Hezekiah for that. So he builds extra walls, and we can still see the walls, those extra walls in they've excavated in Jerusalem, the walls of Hezekiah, the extra ones that he built.
Yeah. So you can see this, you know, 22 verse 8, where it talks, on that day you looked to the weapons in the house of the forest. You saw that there were many breaches in the walls of the city of David. You collected water from the lower pool. You counted the houses of Jerusalem so that you could tear them down to fortify the wall. You made a reservoir between the walls for the waters of the ancient pool, but you did not look to the one who made it or consider the one who created it long ago.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It's like, so we're going to do all this before we even inquire.
Yeah, that's right. You know. Well, and it was more than just, God, can you help us? Actually, he's looking for more than that. There's a spiritual problem here because it says in verse 12 of chapter 22, just to make so people know where we're up to. It says in verse 12, The Lord Almighty called you on that day to weep and to wail, to tear out your hair and put on sackcloth. Mm. But see, there is joy and revelry, slaughtering of cattle and killing of sheep, eating of meat, drinking of wine. Let us eat and drink, you say, for tomorrow we die. I mean,
so essentially they've said, there's no point holding out for God. We're done for. Let's just have all the
let's
fun
just
now.
Do our best. Yeah,
have let's all just the have fun. The fun because we're going to be dead.
Come on. You know? I mean,
so God, God's not in control, really. It's all over.
Yeah. That's right. In chapter 23, there's a prophecy against Tyre. Tyre is the other nation that tends to be.
You don't want to touch on Shebna just before. I mean, it's not important, but just this was a royal, some kind of royal, official royal, very proud person, built himself a grand tomb in Judah. And then God actually, Isaiah makes a prediction that he'll actually end up exiled and die somewhere else and not even get to use his tomb. And
that's continuous with what's said before, because they're all part in getting on with things. They're building these walls and Shebna builds himself a tomb, and so. He's made, essentially, Isaiah is making an example of him because he's a leading figure in the city.
Do you think Eliakim could have been the ruler that would come and actually rule? Because it seems that for a period of time, he did rule over Judah as a royal anyway, justly. I mean, obviously, sooner or later, he...
There's always this, and this is the thing, there's always that promise. You could be. You could be. It depends on... And it goes back to what I said at the start. God is faithful, and He's will. You can be a part of this if you're faithful.
Yeah, right.
And so it's ultimately the unfaithfulness that, in a sense, just lumps him in with everyone else.
Because God is always
faithful. That's right.
Yep. So then, Tyre,
including Tyre. Yeah.
This was a prominent coastal kind of commercial center on the Mediterranean coast, obviously at the time. Very, important And again, Isaiah predicts the downfall of Tyre over.
And and Judah was always very dependent. So certainly Israel was. That's Ahab's wife, Jezebel, was a princess from Tyre. And so there's this association with Tyre as sort of the great tempter. That essentially Baal worship came up really from that. They were... A lot of the pressure for Baal worship came from Tyre, because a lot of alliances and there was a lot of interaction between Israel and Judah and Tyre, because a lot of the shipping and they did all the transportation, in Solomon's time, all of his transportation that brought all of that wealth and shipped off all of his trade, it was all done by the Phoenicians.
Yeah.
So Tyre is the capital of Phoenicia.
So. And of course, Tyre was then conquered by the Assyrians, again by Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, and then again actually by Alexander the Great in the 4th century. So, Tyre's constantly been...
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Judged. After it, it gets a hard time. And again, Isaiah predicts that, because it's very, very difficult, the city of Tyre, because it's of its situation just off the shore, sort of built out an outcrop. Mm. It's, difficult to invade and conquer, but,
It's also valuable if you can.
It took a while, actually, because it's a very difficult city to attack. But it's predicted that it will, and certainly it did. The vision is cast wide here in chapter 24, because you get this oracle about the devastation of the earth. And this is a sort of a, eschatological, because it's looking beyond at the end, the end of the age very much, but it's seeing in the events that are happening a bit of a foretaste of the end of the age. It's interesting that through this chapter, the next couple of chapters, you get this, almost this theme of these cities, the idea of cities comes up. You've got the city, the earth keeps referring to a city. And again, that sort of Babylon theme again, a little bit there, because it talks about in verse 10, the ruined city lies desolate, because he's seeing this, right? He's seeing ahead of time. And the earth is depicted as a ruined city, as a city left in ruins with its gates battered down. And because he says, so it will be on the earth among the nations. And it's interesting here, though, too, in the midst of all of this, as he sees the downfall of all the nations, it says here, but I said, I waste away, woe is me. He's really feeling this.
Mm. And yet, right before that, there's those verses that talk about the people raising their voices and singing praise.
Yeah.
And it's almost like God's people leap into songs of rejoicing while God is still sort of punishing the world.
Yeah.
And Isaiah's kind of saying we should be mourning, as Isaiah was, as you say, wearing sackcloth. Yeah. And I think, perhaps even for us today, sometimes when we see what we would consider to perhaps be evil or poor, terrible things happening in the world, we're kind of quick to judge oh, good God's getting them. Actually, God wants us to mourn. And it raises that whole question about where's the lament in the life of our church? God weeps and over these things that are going to happen and have happened and continue to happen, and yet where is our lament in the church? Yeah. I think that's a big question that we need to answer at some point in time.
And it's not like it's one or the other. They actually go together.
That's right.
And this is the interesting thing in these oracles. You do actually see them going together quite consistently. Because there is real joy in the vision beyond.
Yes.
And I think maybe even in and you're talking here about verse 14
through to 16,
of chapter 24. There's a sense in which he's looking beyond to the rejoicing of God's people in that day, because that is always an important theme in the midst of oracles of judgment. There's always this sense, but God's people are going to be shielded and protected, and you get the same thing in Revelation. So there's a sense that there's this joy there, and yet there's in the seeing of that.
Mm.
There's this sadness for Isaiah, because, and I think, as you say, there's a real appropriateness about that. We have such a great hope, and we rejoice, as Paul says, in the hope of the glory of God, but because we rejoice in that hope, we therefore lament the fact that there are so many that don't have that hope.
Yes.
You know, and so the themes of rejoicing and lamentation, they really go together in biblical spirituality.
Yeah.
They really go together, because the more you rejoice in God's salvation, the more you lament for those that don't have that.
Mm.
And you see, this is actually what you see here in Isaiah. I mean,
and this is why the church, you know, as you said, we need to embody, you know, as Isaiah did, we need to embody. This is why you see, I think we do see the church being involved in so much in the community and trying to help the oppressed and deal with these issues. And I think it's important that we do that more and more, because that is us, in a sense, lamenting what we see as broken, rather than just being in our club on Sunday and singing happy songs and then going, I'm going to shut my eyes to all the bad stuff. And we actually need to be out there.
Yeah.
You know, feeling the pain that God feels as he sees people going to hell in reality, you know?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And those, as I said,
they go together. Correct.
They just go together. And I see this all the way through these oracles, and they do in the Psalms as well. And you just, you see that coupling. And it's because of the age we're living. We're not in heaven yet.
No.
The predictions are, it's a, you know, great rejoicing. And we have a taste of that now. So we have a, we have this amazing heavenly joy now, but that doesn't mean that we're happy about everything that happens all the time.
No.
That's the important thing.
Yeah.
That, you know, we're broken people living in a broken world, and, you know, we can rejoice in God, but we lament the state of the world around us. And as you say, that's meant to be the driver for us to actually do something about that. Let's cast a bit of light here, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, if there's darkness, then cast a bit of light. Just don't just withdraw into a living in the light club.
Yes.
Let's actually be the people of light and empathize, get in there with the people and feel what they're feeling like. Again, you know, like even Isaiah does this. Yeah. He's not saying, yay, for down with the nations. No, he's really feeling the pain.
And he's taking a sackcloth off and he's walking around barefoot and naked to say, this is what it's going to be like.
That's right.
This is what it's like.
Yeah.
That's good.
And so, as I said, you get this, you know, the world system depicted like a city being, you know, ruined. And then in chapter 26, it says, in that day, this song will be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. God makes salvation, its walls and its ramparts. So you get this sense of, you know, the world system as a city and the city of God, you know, the kingdom of God is depicted as a city. Of course, Augustine wrote the famous book, The City of God, which is basically a survey of, initially, that book, The City of God, is a big survey of the story of the Bible leading up to his present day. Mm. And it's all, you know, this is all about, you know, which city you're going to be a part of, and you know, encouraging the people to make sure that they're part of the right city.
Yeah.
In fact, in chapter 28, and we'll touch on chapter 28 in the next episode as well, Stu.
Yeah, great.
But he says, it's that famous prophecy, "See, I lay a stone in Zion, a tested stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation. The one who relies on it will never be stricken with panic." So he's saying, even in this city now, in the imagery of the two cities, he speaks about the foundation. This is about foundations. Which foundation is a sure foundation here?
Yeah.
You know? It's not Egypt or, you know, or the nations around you. I've laid a sure foundation in Zion. And this is, in a sense, the promises of God, you know, which ultimately are embodied in Jesus Christ. And so, you know, this is this verse is quoted in the New Testament, you know, very much about Jesus and so forth. So I think, again, with the two cities imagery, it's all about the foundation. There's a foundation here. There's something to trust in here, guys, that is absolutely certain. And if you trust in Yahweh, he will come through for it. In fact, whether or not you trust in Yahweh, that is the thing that's going to determine whether you are part of seeing God's faithfulness or not. And for those who do trust, he will be absolutely sure to be faithful.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact us, ask questions, see all our resources and much more at our website, thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these shows will inspire you to go deeper and thrive.